army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 079 of Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. In anticipation of a forthcoming trip that I have to visit children and grandchildren, this is about a week out. Usually I customarily do my podcast on a fortnightly basis, with the exception of the interregnum I took because of our move and a health crisis that has since been largely resolved. But then again, I am approaching my expiration date as a human being in this meat sack. So ordinarily, I'm probably 24, 48, 72 hours prior to publication on the customary Monday mornings when I publish it. This one's going to be a little further out, so I'm trying to isolate my observations to things that are what one could say is perennial and timely in human conflict, the way I'm going to characterize the contents of this podcast. That being the case, I would urge all of my paid subscribers to be aware of a new policy that I inaugurated last time, which is that not only do you get a signal chat with me and your fellow paid subscribers, not only do you have the direct chat on my Substack, and not only do you get the Chasing Ghost microbursts, which are the occasional 10, 15, 20-minute bloviations that I publish for my paid subscribers only, but from this point forward, every one of these will be published 24 hours earlier for my paid subscribers than my not paid subscribers. I do not want to diminish the literally thousands of unpaid subscribers. You have access to all of my content, with the exception of the private conversations that I just discussed and the microbursts that come on occasion. I published four of those, and I will continue to do so. So I have my brain zephyrs that I will publish in Substack notes, which some of you have access to. I find it's much better than the haiku that Twitter, that the X has, when it comes to exposure of ideas, whether I come up with them or I've stolen them from others, trying to give them the best attribution I can to the brain zephyr that came about. But one struck me, and I think it resonates a little bit with what's going on in the world today. When it comes to high trust and low trust societies, the high trust societies tend to be the ones that make the scientific, engineering, architectural, and art advancements that are the envy of the world, as it were. I'm fond of saying that when one looks at heritage Europeans, or dare I say white populations, there are very few third world countries on planet Earth that have majority white populations. There are a number of reasons why this happens, and one of them that I would suggest, and I'm reading directly from my own quote here, is that the discipline of accuracy in engineering and machining generates a culture where honesty and integrity are vital. Standards are obtained and maintained. These are the foundations of wealth production in both goods and services. Industrial revolutions are cultural and social revolutions that leverage and capitalize on these cultural traits that emerge in high trust societies. Now, at the conclusion of that short brain zephyr on notes, I said, prove me wrong. So I welcome all the folks in my listening audience, whether you are paid or unpaid, to come back at me with your evidence to say that maybe I have erred in my observations. I also came upon a very curious document while I was intellectually meandering around the web, and I ran across a paper that was titled EUSSR. I'm not saying that I'm the one who came up with EUSSR, European Union Soviet Socialist Republic, because obviously I didn't, because this title is on a page in a document that was published in 1938 by Vladimir Bukovsky and Pavel Stroilov. It reads in the title, EUSSR, the Soviet roots of European integration. Our slogan is a worldwide Soviet Union. Anthem of the Comintern, 1938. Published by Sovereignty Publications, Worcester Park, Surrey, England, 1938. So this whole idea of the EU and Brussels and Western European with the recently integrated Eastern European notions of alignment that they have on the continent, that this idea of a supranational entity that would rule over all of the disparate countries in Europe is nothing new. I found that to be interesting. I'm not going to pursue that in this podcast, but I may pursue it further in another episode. As any of you who know and have been listening to me for a while on this 3 years that we've been discussing these things, both irregular warfare and chasing ghosts, and more conventional conflict and global conflict in War Notes, my companion podcast. By the way, this episode marks the 99th episode of in the combination of Chasing Ghosts and War Notes. So the next episode, whether it be Chasing Ghosts or War Notes, will be the 100th episode that I have published in what I did not know would be either short-lived or long-lived, until I assume room temperature, of doing these particular podcasts and broadcasts. So here we are. I'm going to quote from some of my Substack co-conspirators when we're discussing the salvo competition in Iran and what is going on in this integrated air and missile defense armed kerfuffle between the BRICS countries, Russia, China, Iran, even though Iran has been the only one that's been assailed, and also the United States, Israel, and European nations that have aligned themselves with this. So you have listened to me for a while, and if you have, you'll find that this is rather repetitive, maybe even a broken record, but that's that drones, UASs, UAVs, whether they are airborne, groundborne, underground, wherever they may be, this is the future for the remainder of this century as far as the conduct of human conflict and human bloodletting and war. I will be sure to put these references in the show notes so that you can peruse them yourselves. So there's a guy named X-Ray Lima, which is a play on XXL. He's XXL Dude. So I certainly want to give him due credit for the one who inspired the discussion that we're going to have. He talks about what drones are, what drones actually are, the logistics reality, drone vulnerabilities, detection and counter-observation, the thermal two-way street, the drone two-way street, the law of economy, electricity as a signature, analysis paralysis, resolve, and other such things. So let's see which one of these things we want to reflect on before we move on to the other Substack essay that I found so compelling for today's discussion. But let's get down to brass tacks, and the brass tacks are this. If one were to remove the golden thread of radars, which are very expensive, which take a long time to produce, and if you don't defend them correctly and lose them, if you have production boondoggles and throughput problems in the West, you will have a great difficulty in replacing these. Why is there importance in radars and fire detection centers? It's because drones, UAVs, UASs, missiles, all of these things in this 21st century era of conflict are so vital and important that you must detect them beforehand. So let me just give you a little bit of radar 101. You cannot have a fire direction center at a given tell, a tactical erection launcher or silos or off the pylon of aircraft or launched in one fashion or another, whether ground to air, air to ground, or air to ground in a way in which it has come shipborne, or maybe it's come from a ground asset. The bottom line is you cannot efficiently or effectively target things without detecting them in the first place. Now, here's what radars do. Radars detect things in the ether using the measurements and signals that they are calibrated for to detect incoming missiles, incoming drones, incoming aircraft, incoming bombs. Whatever the case may be, they are calibrated to that very thing. And they do a variety of things. First and foremost, they provide a cueing mechanism. And what a cueing mechanism does is it allows a radar to go out in a given parabola and angle of absorption, as it were, facing a certain direction, so that in that cueing, it sniffs out the emanations from these, whatever it is calibrated to detect, and then it classifies them. This classification process is vital because the classification process says, is it friendly? Is it neutral? Is it dangerous? If it's danger, what is the nature of the characteristics of the danger that it has? What is its proximity? What is its speed? All of these things are determined, and they are assigned discrete identifying markers in the collating of all this information to determine what's going to be targeted, what's going to be launched against. And once again, I would urge all of you to know, despite what the media says, which tends to be militarily illiterate, especially the coprophile media, that mainstream media that is dying at a pace that is not fast enough for me, what you discover is that an interception calculus for a probability of kill beyond 90% demands the lofting of 2 to 4 minimum munitions against whatever is incoming. There are a variety of things that the offensive missileers can do. They can send in the cheaper and oldest lot numbers from their ammunition supply points to sponge up all of these interceptors that are sent aloft, maybe even sponging them up to the point where the interceptors that are being used to defend in the integrated air and missile defense of the target area of these missiles taps out and goes Winchester. They run out of munitions, quite literally, and the savvier opponent who can forecast and predict this kinetic magazine exhaustion can use that then to send in the more effective drones or missiles, the heavy hitters and those kind of things, because quite literally then the defender is on their back foot because they're having to reconstitute the empty magazines. That's one method. The other method is target the radars, target the fire direction centers. As I mentioned, I think it was episode 19, target all portable power in expeditionary U.S. forces. If one were to take out every genset that had been alive or was just turning on and made that the number one target of your campaign, you could really set the U.S. armed expeditionary forces on their back foot by removing their ability to compute, by removing their ability to assess, by removing their ability to launch, by removing all kinds of capabilities that rely on energy. Because, as my friend says back at the Naval Postgraduate School, wars, and this is Tom Clancy in the first two clauses, in war, tactics are the province of the amateur, and furthermore, logistics are the province of the professional military artist. But in the end, it is energy that is the war winner, the conservation, expansion, maintenance, and creation thereof that allows you to have the means to continue to fight a prolonged conflict. One quick note on prolonged conflicts. They're all prolonged conflicts. I'll bet if one were to go back, and I don't have the evidence for this, so this is just going to be anecdotal, I'll bet there were guarantees from the current administration in the United States that this war would last for 1, 2, 3, 4 days. You do recall the 12-day war that recently happened several months ago between Israel and Iran, where they were batting back and forth in a game of martial volleyball, their various missiles and drones to strike at places within their countries. Well, it just so happens that war always takes longer. So back to XXL's very worthy article, I'll put it in the show notes. In drones, I'm quoting, he says, "I'm not talking about jet-sized military UAVs, I'm talking about small drones, the ones that fit in backpacks, the ones everyone fixates on. Warfare has always been an arms race of adaptation, tactics, counter-tactics, new tools, new vulnerabilities," end of quote. What he doesn't mention here is that war is also about fragility and anti-fragility. And for those of you who are longtime listeners, you know that I'm very fond of Nassim Taleb's framing of how the world works when it comes to that kind of thing. I've often entertained that all counterinsurgencies are anti-fragile, which means that over time they tend to be much more adaptive, and that all, no, dare I say, the lion's share of all counterinsurgencies are very fragile indeed. And we will find the same thing will inform in this conflict with Iran and the BRICS countries against the Western countries. XXL goes on, what drones actually are. He says, quote, "A versatile force multiplier, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, a limited delivery vessel, disposable, stealthy, until they aren't." By the way, that last clause, stealthy, until they aren't. The West, America in particular, has spent tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in this lark, this windmill tilting about stealth, where they thought that if they could have left of bang, the ability to place their assets that were going to deliver kinetic weaponry, or in very limited cases, non-kinetic weaponry, and they could get them there to surprise, as Clausewitz would tell us about, surprise the enemy, that would give America a huge advantage. That is an advantage for third world countries and developing countries. It is not an advantage for first world countries, because when one looks at Russia, China, and by extension, Iran, you find that their long-wave radar receptors and capabilities for detecting stealth aircraft, this has been since Serbia in the 1990s, has a proven track record of proving stealth to be very expensive and very ineffective. He goes on, the logistics reality. Electricity in war is finite. Electronics are fragile. Supply chains matter. End of quote. All of the above is absolutely true, and it is the war winning of energy production and maintenance that ultimately is going to win a war, especially in this case. So I'm not going to spend all the time to go through every aspect of this article, but I call it to your attention because it's very savvy, and he makes observations that are very important to this. He talks about in one section something called analysis paralysis, in which he says, quote, "There is a growing segment of this community that has frozen itself by overanalyzing one conflict. Ukraine is important, but it is not universal. No two wars are the same. Korea was not Vietnam. Urban fighting is not mountain fighting. Proxy war is not internal collapse. A homeland crisis would look very different." He says, terrain matters, culture matters, weather matters, scale matters. And I agree with all of that, but also ambition matters. Now, his audience was one where, from his particular vantage point, he was looking at drones as a threat to an indigenous reaction in the United States and the West to invasion or things like that. But nonetheless, I found his observations on drone warfare to be pretty captivating. And now we're going to move on to the next one. Published on 6 March 2026 by Policy Tensor, T-E-N-S-O-R, it will be in the show notes. Title is Why the U.S. is Facing Strategic Defeat, Drone Missiles, THAAD. He begins, quote, "Irrespective of the ever-shifting war aims peddled out by administration officials, there is a clear and obvious sense in which strategic victory and defeat are defined here. If the United States cannot, either through direct denial or military coercion, suppress Iran's attacks on its own assets and those of its allies and protectorates, that would constitute a strategic defeat for the U.S. If the U.S. declares mission accomplished whilst the Iranians are still firing their weapons at the oil monarchies, U.S. military bases, Israel, and above all, Hormuz is still closed, that would constitute an unambiguous strategic defeat of the United States, end of quote. So this is probably going to reach your ears a week after I broadcast it. A week is a year in conflict, maybe even a century. We will see what obtains by that time, but I do think that everything is in the cards here to spell out a strategic defeat, if not a grand strategic defeat. The grand strategic defeat here would be that the consolidation of the BRICS forces, which would be China, India, Russia, and other smaller nation states that have formed an alliance that most folks in the coprophile media would refer to as an axis of evil, which is how they have been characterized ever since the Soviet Union fell in 91 and 92. And at last, we saw this unipolar world, especially in the 21st century, descend into a bipolar world between these BRICS allied nations and the allied nations of the West. And I would also point out to you that since this administration has been in office, there has been a fissure, a schism, as it were, between the EU, SSR, and Brussels, Belgium, and the NATO alliance by extension, and the United States. Even though, while I don't credit the administration with 3D and 4D chess, I am amused by the fact that for decades, if not generations, the Americans have said, please, please, take the load off our hands and share the load of defense spending and such. And all of a sudden we find magically, as a result of saber-rattling rhetorical slashes and Trump's inimitable way to play ahead of his competitors, all of a sudden we find NATO countries signing up to spend far more, relatively speaking, than they did in the past as a result of their natural-born opposition to what this administration represents to them. Now, the author here does an Iran drone war model, and he does it in a calculus equation, which I found very compelling. Remember what Heinlein said about math? It is the bifurcation and differentiation between us and primates, the fact that we can count on more than 10 fingers and find sophisticated ways to calculate, if not forecast and predict, how nature works. According to him, he says, even in the highly implausible extreme scenario where Iran cannot reconstitute any production sites and the U.S. degrades them at the rate of 90% per month, Iran can still sustain a high rate of fire for 4 months. Now, by all considerations, especially when one looks at the U.S. magazine larder and all of its exquisite platforms and weapon systems, such as THAAD, Patriot missiles, the PAACs, all of these very sophisticated SM standard missile and very expensive missile systems, there is a limited number of those in the inventory, and there is a severe throughput infrastructure problem in the United States economy that is shaped by many forces that are generations old. That means that one can't shift around the throughput problem, the shipbuilding problem, the missile building problem, the munitions building problem overnight, over weeks, over months. This is something that is systemic that will take years. There was a projection 2 years ago, and it's probably been updated by the CSBA, where they said in order to replenish and reconstitute the total Stinger missile inventory that was sent over to the Ukraine to send into the laps of the Russians in that unfortunate conflict would take, I hope you're sitting down for this, 18 years at minimum to reconstitute with current factory and throughput considerations. He goes on, quote, is there a military solution? What can the U.S. do? John Warden's decapitation idea was supposed to work. It did not. There is absolutely no sign of any political instability in Iran. Zero, as a senior European official told the Washington Post. Then what, the Kurdish stratagem? Are we going to take the Kurds, arm them, give them materiel, give them probably unlimited support in personnel, weapons, and funding, but there are a finite number of Kurds. There's another problem using the Kurds. The Kurds have traditionally been part of the PKK and other communist insurgency elements that have been given Turkey a hell of a time for the last decades and generations. And that is a consideration. Will the Kurds devote themselves to the overthrow of Iran, and they certainly don't have the numbers heft to do so, and then abandon and declare those areas that have been targeted by Turkey to be a problem solved? They will not. At best, this is quoting from him, at best they can create a breakaway statelet. That is not going to move the needle on the question. Iran can and will continue its relentless attacks across the Gulf. Whether or not the Afghan model of U.S. air power combined with ground force proxies succeeds in creating a sort of Erbil in northwestern Iran. So that's not going to get you any closer to solving this problem. He goes on, what is left? Ground forces? Does the U.S. have the appetite? And even if the U.S. did have the appetite, can the U.S. even hope to prevail in a prolonged counterinsurgency war? In order to achieve the same force-to-space or the same force-to-space population ratio as Iraq, the U.S. will have to deploy 600,000 to 1 million troops. This is the very limits of American armed strength. By the way, take a look at the mountainous regions that comprise nearly 65% of all the terrain in Iran. And you will discover, if you pay attention to history, that mountainous terrain, whether in a conventional conflict or in a counterinsurgency conflict, are among the most difficult of any war-making enterprise. I offer to you as a counterinsurgency example, what happened in Afghanistan, especially in the foothills of the Himalayas, and from a more conventional conflict perspective, what happened to the Allies in 44 and 45 when it came to besting the mountainous regions of northern Italy during World War II? It was a hard-won fight. A hard-won fight in the middle of a war that had globally mobilized the Western industrial might that has not seen anything like it since 1945. And he says something that, for those of you who have listened to me for a while, will seem to be a resonance of what you've heard from me. Quote, but it gets worse still. I wrote about the implications of our mature precision strike regime that Kropinovich predicted in the early 1990s. This is an international military order where standoff precision strike capabilities have diffused far beyond the technologically advanced great powers, I wrote, but even I underestimated the Iranians. The Iranians are not just deploying hypersonic missiles that the U.S. has been unable to develop, by the way, end of quote, unable to develop in two programs that have spent tens of billions of dollars. Going back to him, quote, they don't just have the largest missile arsenal in the Middle East. Recent military developments have revealed surprising Iranian reconnaissance strike capabilities. And mind you, again, for those who have listened to my stuff for a while, you know that I am quite in awe of the Russian strike fire reconnaissance complex and what they have achieved not only since the beginning of the century in forming a very rational and effective and timely ability to detect, collate, sort, and target threats with their combined artillery forces, because keep in mind that the Russians are so effective with drones, especially in the Ukraine. And the Ukrainians aren't half bad, too, because they're emulating their Russian foe, because the Russians have always characterized drones as another permutation of artillery, and the Russians, arguably, in the 20th century, are the masters of artillery fires. Quote, the Iranians have managed to hit every single American military base in the region, but that is not the half of it. THAAD is one of the most powerful ballistic missile defense systems in the world. If anything should be invulnerable to attack, it is this system. The Iranians have managed to hit and likely disable every single THAAD battery in the region. All five of them. Now, of course, that comes from CNN reportage radar bases, and this was published March 6th, radar bases housing the key U.S. missile interceptor have been hit in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. Satellite images confirm. All U.S. air bases in the Gulf have come under sustained attack. Are they able to fly sorties from them, even if at a degraded operational tempo? Or have they been abandoned and the sorties are being launched from faraway places and bases with aerial refueling? He goes on, Grok was able to answer in the affirmative. The United States has had to pull back its forces from the region. The sortie rate that the U.S. can generate has been severely degraded by Iranian attacks. The U.S. can degrade Iranian drone and missile capabilities, as they have averred, but they have it marked down by 35 to 50%, still revealing that there's a tremendous amount of them that are still there. He says, quote, the Trump administration is now in a real pickle of its own making. There is no military solution in sight. With the destruction of the THAAD shields and with the interceptor inventories running out, Iran's countervalue strategy will be able to impose escalating, not decaying costs on the U.S. and its allies and all countries on Earth. Because of the stunning success of Iranian counterforce strikes, they've basically made U.S. bases in the region practically unusable. The U.S. cannot generate enough sorties, even if the drone war math was promising, which I have shown you is not. End of quote. Take a look at his calculations in the article, and you will find them quite compelling. He closes, the U.S. is therefore staring at an unambiguous strategic defeat here. Hurling bombs at the enemy has never worked in the entire century of air power. There is no reason to think that it will coerce the Iranians into submission. They have the strategic advantage here, and they're going to press it. It is also possible that the Russians and behind them the Chinese will resupply and rearm the Iranians. If that happens, as seems likely, this will turn into a reverse Ukraine. End of quote. Now, one thing that I would like my readers who know that I like to look back at history to find ways in which we can avail ourselves of past successes and the numerous past failures. From 1756 to 1764-65, there was something called the French and Indian Wars on the North American continent, in which the British were trying to best the French and Spanish holdings on the continent and establish a stranglehold of British suzerainty on said continent. Well, it just so happens in the last 3 years of that conflict, through sheer military brilliance on the part of the British, who I'm fond of saying, win all of their victories in spite of their best efforts. But in this one bright, shining moment, they did tremendous things. But tremendous things come with a cost. And the cost for this was that the Spanish and the French, from 1765 to 1775, established a very serious, deep, and lasting relationship with the British citizens known as the colonials on the Atlantic seaboard. And I would suggest if it weren't for that assistance, that training, the weapons, the materiel, the diplomacy, and the off-putting full world war that was going on at the time between the French and the Spanish and the British, because I wouldn't call the U.S. a sideshow from 1775 to 1783, but British military forces were also absorbed in other concerns. Fast forward to today, and I think that is the very thing that we are seeing now. We are seeing not only a realignment of earthly forces and global military power, we are seeing not only peer military competition being bested by one would characterized as a non-first world nation. I certainly wouldn't call Iran a third world nation, but it certainly isn't a peer competitor in the sense of the Russians and the Chinese, and not merely because they don't have nuclear weapons, but because of what Islam does to nation states. I think that 48 of the 51 Islamic majority nation states around the earth are what Trump would uncharitably referred to as shitholes and authoritarian hellholes. That is certainly the case here. I am not here to defend Iranian domestic policy and what's happened there as a result of the 1953 imposition of the CIA-placed government in Iran, which was overthrown in 1979 by the Mohammedan Shahs and the imposition of a religious state, a non-secular state, but one which still had a scientific brilliance unrivaled by many of their Islamist brethren states planet-wide, especially in the Middle East. There's a very interesting book that I've mentioned before that's called Armies of Sand by Kenneth Pollack, where he talks about the absolute inefficiency and ineffectiveness of Arab or Islamic armies to achieve a conventional force superiority or even supremacy against Western militaries. But of course, when we look at the converse of that coin, look what I did there, and we look at their ability at insurgency and defeating counterinsurgency, defeating coin forces, it is almost unparalleled in their ability. One would be prone to ask, has a Western coin effort in the Middle East effectively stomped out the life of and future of any Islamic insurgency movement? And the answer is probably no. I would offer as Exhibit A, when the new head chopper president affiliated with Al-Qaeda of Syria was invited to the red carpet at the White House a mere 23 years after their last visit to New York City. And there you have it. Their signal successes when it comes to insurgency are unparalleled in the Middle East. I love to read the comments in articles. And by the way, if an article doesn't have a comment section, I tend not to put too much provenance in it as far as its authenticity. There was a comment by one Francisco de Anconia, and you'll find it if you read the article and go down to the comments. I want to quote from it. He says, quote, "The U.S. and Israel attack Iran, which has been preparing underground missile manufacturing cities for two decades. Iran climbs the escalatory ladder by hitting infrastructure across the region. Iran blinds the U.S. radars, which invites an escalatory response, which invites more escalation. Eventually, out of desperation, Israel starts hitting Iran's oil infrastructure. Iran responds by hitting Med oil and gas platforms. Israel hits more. Iran hits Saudi and UAE and Kuwait, all Sunni countries, by the way, not Shia-like Islam in Iran. Pretty soon, 25% of the energy infrastructure is permanently destroyed. Energy importing economies collapse, Gulf economies collapse, and monarchies fall. This leaves Russia and China basically as the U.S. was after World War II, but without firing a shot. They can resupply Iran at any point to keep the conflict going as long as it needs to bleed the West dry. Russia walks over Ukraine. European regimes fall to populist. Russia saves Europe with energy. China buys the whole world with its hard reserves at pennies on the dollar. Israel stands surrounded by a million hostiles, but without the U.S. to back it up. The U.S. financial house of cards falls, and its magazine is spent." End of quote. I find that quite apocalyptic and millenarian, but nonetheless, there are some compelling suggestions in there in the state of the world today. So I want to leave you with this. I think because of throughput infrastructure concerns, manufacturing concerns, budget woes, and the fact that the U.S. may be reaching its limit of not only debt accumulation, not deficit, but debt accumulation and its ability to tax the starch out of its citizens for more money to go in these military larks, that it may very well find itself coming to the negotiating table at last to seek a frozen peace, a frozen stalemate, as it were, with Iran. Now, in 2022, when the Russians invaded the Ukraine, you could find time after time for the time since that war started, that all attempts at negotiation tend to be stymied by folks in the U.S. administrations and the European administrations. Surprisingly enough, it appears that the U.S. and their Western allies, in my estimation, in a forecast, not a prediction, is that they will have to come to the peace table and negotiate some kind of settlement to resolve this war of choice that's been taken on by the Israelis and the U.S. As with all of these kind of conflicts, and as I discovered as a professional observer of human war and conflict and student of how that's happened over thousands of years, I found something disturbing in the Ukraine conflict where I didn't know what data or datum to believe. I did not know what the media was trying to feed us as far as either factual data, sober observations, or merely gaslighting me with propaganda. I still haven't come to a conclusion on what that may be. Am I predicting that the U.S. will lose in this war? I am not. Am I predicting that the Iranians will lose in this war? I am not. It is too premature for that kind of conjecture at this time. So with that, you will find that I'm going to make these episodes a tad shorter than they usually are, because I am still recovering from the TIA that I had recently, and I bored you with the details of that in an earlier episode. But in other news, I do find myself with a new bunker complex here, much further north in the glorious Florida Peninsula. We are happily getting ensconced and preparing to situate ourselves yet again, and I eagerly await unpacking my library, which happens to be sitting in dozens of book boxes, waiting to see the light of day again so that I could sit comfortably in my library chair and read what everybody else had to say and what they went through ages past to give me the proper perspective on what the future portends for all of us. Stay safe, stay alive, stay alert. And that notion of sleeper cells may be out there, but in that notion of sleeper cells that I spent so much time in those episodes on Storming America making those forecasts, I want to be dead wrong. So that concludes this episode. If you wish to get in touch with me, and I love chatting in conversations and discussions with my audience members. So go to Substack. You can go to my Substack, which the link should be in the show notes. You can also go to my Twitter page, where on occasion, I don't spend a whole lot of time on there anymore if I can help it. You can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is also in the show notes. And for those of you who are my paid subscribers, hand over chest, thank you so much for supporting my efforts and throwing money into the tip jar so that I can buy the books, buy the media, get the stuff that I need to provide you with episodes that I hope are scintillating, maybe even slightly uncomfortable, but always interesting. So with that, thank you so much. And remember, this appears to be one episode short of 100 episodes in Chasing Ghosts and War Notes. And if it weren't for your participation and such, I would not be where I am as far as making progress in getting to that point. If on your favorite podcast vendor, you would be so kind as to leave 4 or 5 stars if you like the content, and I am forever in your debt if you were to provide scintillating narrative description of why you enjoy this podcast so much. So this is Bill bidding you adieu. Bill out.